This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
it's a strategy for the next 5 years called Start Free, Stay Free, AIDS Free, which is to focus on reducing new pediatric infections. That's a Start Free. The Stay Free is to really invest in and do important work with adolescents and young people and reduce the rate of new infections, which is quite worrying, particularly among adolescents, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. And AIDS Free really means all those people who are living with the virus need to be on treatment.
That's Chip Lyons, President and CEO of the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. The organization joined forces with other partners to launch an initiative to combat pediatric AIDS, which is still an epidemic in sub-Saharan Africa. We'll have full details coming up.
Also, today is World AIDS Day, where the 78 million who became infected over the past 35 years and the 35 million people who died are remembered. And Gambian voters are deciding today whether to keep longtime President Yahya Jammeh in power.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour: today is World AIDS Day, a day to remember the 78 million who became infected over the past 35 years and the 35 million people who died. More than 18 million people are now on life-saving treatment around the world, but there's still no cure or vaccine. UNAIDS says infections are not declining among young adults, especially young women, and stigma and discrimination are hampering efforts to stop the spread of the disease. Also, co-infection of HIV and TB is a growing problem. Tuberculosis caused about one-third of AIDS-related deaths last year. There were about 2 million new HIV infections in 2015. Most of those living with HIV/AIDS, about 25 million, are in sub-Saharan Africa. The UN Sustainable Development Goals call for an end to the AIDS epidemic by 2030.
A great deal has been achieved in recent years in treating and preventing HIV infection, but a vaccine remains elusive despite many years of research. A new vaccine trial is getting underway in South Africa called HVTN-702. It's based on a vaccine trial conducted in Thailand in 2009 that showed it was possible to prevent HIV infection. However, it was not effective enough to go to market. Among those calling for greater vaccine research is Mitchell Warren, head of the AIDS advocacy organization, AVAC. From London, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa about the South African vaccine trial.
The HVTN-702, which is actually kind of a code word for the HIV Vaccine Trials Network, which is funded by the U.S. National Institutes of Health, have just begun this trial in South Africa. It's actually the first efficacy study of an HIV vaccine in over 5 years, and it's actually testing a modified version of a vaccine that was the one we've talked about over the years that came out from Thailand now 7 years ago, almost to the day 7 years ago, where we found for the first and so far only time that an AIDS vaccine had any benefit at all. That was this very modest 30% protection in Thailand. And so this study is really important. It's been re-engineered to hopefully do better than that 30%, but we don't know if it's going to work at all, but that's why we do the study.
Mitchell, why did it take 7 years to get around to doing this study?
This is a great question, and I think we now understand better that HIV vaccine research is this long-term investment. I think there are a couple of things that made this challenging. One, because it was only 30% effective, it had to actually be modified in a number of ways. And the study was originally done in Thailand, and the vaccine that was developed originally in Thailand was based on the HIV subtype that circulates in Thailand. It's actually a different subtype than in South Africa. So first they had to modify the vaccine to be relevant to the South African epidemic. They then had to do a small study to show that it was safe in South Africa. And then they wanted to see if you could do better than 30%. They changed what's called the adjuvant. That's one of the parts of a vaccine that can help the immune system respond better. And finally, they needed to add a booster. So they needed to see about adding a booster injection 12 months after starting the trial in that smaller phase trial. So it takes longer than anyone wants. It takes too long. In my opinion, as an advocate, we clearly need to have this study go forward, but we also need to use this as a lesson that we need to be doing it faster. We can't take these long delays in between trials, or we're never going to get ahead of this epidemic.
So now that the trial has begun, any idea how long it will take?
The trial is enrolling about 5,400 individuals in South Africa. That is going to take at least a couple of years to recruit that many people. And the study is designed to follow participants for over 4 years. So we're only going to get the results in 2021 or early 2022. And if it works, and that's an if, but if it works in the trial, then you have to figure out how to get it registered, how to manufacture at scale. So we are still a number of years away if this vaccine works at all. We also have to recognize that even if it works, this is not the end of the road for vaccine development. Even with a positive result, you know that this vaccine is likely not going to get us as good as we want it to be. It may be in the 50% range, and maybe that will get it licensed, but we clearly still need to do better with different vaccines. Also, this vaccine does require 5 doses over the year period, and then possibly additional boosters beyond that period. Again, that would be better than no vaccine at all, but we clearly need to prioritize developing other vaccines that could do even better in the longer term.
So, Mitchell, by the time we find out the results of this vaccine candidate in South Africa, the HIV/AIDS epidemic will be about 40 years old. Is that correct?
Indeed, that's exactly right. We're about 35 years and counting, and we will certainly be at least at 40 years before we get this result.
What are the best options at this time to at least treat, prevent, and stem the epidemic?
It's never just one component. For treatment, that means rolling out current antiretroviral treatment to all people who are infected. That's 37 million people, and we're only halfway there. But we also have to prevent infections to begin with, and that means standard provisions of abstinence, being faithful, and male and female condoms that have been around for decades. In addition, we now have voluntary medical male circumcision, which we know to be incredibly effective in a single procedure. And over the last several years, we've seen evidence accruing about the role of pre-exposure prophylaxis or oral PrEP with a pill for prevention. There's also very exciting work about the vaginal ring, and we have a study that's just beginning looking at an injectable form of antiretrovirals for prevention. With the current tools, we may be able to bend the curve of the epidemic, but we will need a vaccine to actually sustain the end of an epidemic in the long term.
That's Mitchell Warren, head of the AIDS advocacy organization AVAC from London. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Well, on World AIDS Day today, a new initiative is being launched. It builds on past successes to end AIDS in children and adolescents by redoubling efforts to prevent new HIV infections. The new effort is called Start Free, Stay Free, AIDS Free. It's led by the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation and its partners, UNAIDS, and the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR. Chip Lyons is president and CEO of the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. He spoke with me about why the fight against pediatric AIDS is not over.
The Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation is working with a number of partners, World Health Organization, UNICEF, UNAIDS, PEPFAR, and what we've termed, it's a strategy for the next 5 years called Start Free, Stay Free, AIDS Free, which is to focus on reducing new pediatric infections. That's a start free. The stay free is to really invest in and do important work with adolescents and young people and reduce the rate of new infections, which is quite worrying, particularly among adolescents, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. And AIDS-free really means all those people who are living with the virus need to be on treatment. That's 1.6 million children globally. That's the focus, those three areas. It's a life cycle approach, and it holds great promise for reducing new infections and getting control of the epidemic.
What is the biggest challenge with adolescents in Africa in preventing and getting them treatment for HIV/AIDS?
Well, there's still a great deal of stigma. Many people are hesitant to come forward and be tested. Everybody should get themselves tested so they know their status, and if they are positive, that they immediately get on treatment. There are challenges around access. People need to be comfortable going to public or private or faith-supported services. But knowledge about the virus, adolescents sometimes and other people might think HIV and AIDS is about other people. It's about everyone. It's in our communities. And so just really providing the information, the peer support, peer educators do a fantastic job of communicating with adolescents and young people. And so there's a variety of actions that are both possible and necessary. So what's important about World AIDS Day, and it's important whether it's on Sundays in church or places of worship or other opportunities, people need to keep talking about HIV and AIDS so that they know how to prevent new infections, how to take care of themselves.
Why do you think there is still a stigma with HIV AIDS?
That's a really good question. There would be multiple reasons for that. Some of it has to do with sort of traditional beliefs, perhaps, of where HIV and AIDS comes from. Obviously, the key populations that have rates of infection, it's hard to really get at in many respects because the sources of that stigma come from so many different deep places of belief and bias towards other people's actions. It's a stubborn problem, and it gets in the way of testing and treatment because we do have the tools to control the epidemic. Everyone needs to ask themselves how they talk about HIV and AIDS and whether they are part of positive conversations so that we can reduce new infections and protect people.
Also, why is there still a high percentage of mother-to-child transmission of HIV AIDS?
There's two ways of looking at that. It's also a good question. It's probably the lowest rate of mother-to-child transmission that we've ever seen. In the last 5 years, we've made, and a number of countries in sub-Saharan Africa have made huge strides. We've reduced mother-to-child transmission by 60% over the last 5 years. That's not to say the job is over by any stretch, but the most important step there is if a woman believes she is pregnant, she needs to know her HIV status and immediately get on treatment, both to protect her health and to dramatically, down to less than a 5% chance, reduce the possibility of transferring the virus to her newborn. I think that's one of the areas where, one, we've made the most progress, but two, over the next several years, we'll continue to drive down new pediatric infection.
Where do you see HIV/AIDS in the future, in the years ahead?
We have several goals. Our overarching goal as the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation is to end AIDS in children. As I said, we've made tremendous strides there, and we believe it is possible to usher in a generation free of HIV and AIDS. We have very specific targets tied to the period between now and 2020. Countries like Uganda and South Africa, Zimbabwe, Lesotho, Swaziland, with particularly high prevalence rates, are doing remarkable work. Their ministries of health, their ministers, nurses, doctors, community workers are doing tremendous work in bringing down new infections. So the period between now and 2020 is going to see further reduction in new pediatric infections. We have to see reductions in new infections among adolescents. And what we do in the next 5 years will tell us a lot about the prospects of achieving that goal by 2030.
Chip Lyons is president and CEO of the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. He spoke with me from Washington.
World AIDS Day has a special significance this year in New York City, where over 100,000 people, mostly gay men, have died from the disease since the epidemic started. Historians say New York was also the place where global activism for cure began. Today, activists, health workers, public officials, and community members unveiled the New York City AIDS Memorial. It's a light-filled, steel outdoor canopy that's nearly 6 meters high. It has flowing water benches for reflection and engraved poetry. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Eric Sawyer, an early AIDS activist and a former advisor to UNAIDS. He told Adam that although he worked hard to help make the memorial a reality, it's still bittersweet.
We lost so many of our friends, and even in situations that are kind of joyous like this, the grief just tries to explode out.
Stepping back for a moment, could you tell me a little bit about the broader history of AIDS in New York and what this memorial commemorates?
The history of AIDS in New York and around the world really is one of stigma, discrimination, and mistreatment of people living with HIV simply because they have a virus or because they're from a population that society in general considers a second-class citizen, whether it be an LGBT, a man who has sex with men, a sex worker, a drug user, or someone just living in poverty. People with HIV are often shunned and looked down upon. And so early on in the epidemic, the early 80s, the world didn't care or didn't respond to the emerging HIV crisis because nobody really cared about those people. They had no voice or no political power. And so those of us in the LGBT community and our support networks, our allies, took to the streets and disrupted governmental processes and disrupted drug companies and basically tried to get in the face of people of power to say, our lives matter, we need treatments, we need a safety net to help us live.
But that stigma, that crisis, wasn't just on the public level. It happened within families, between friends.
Yeah. During the height of the AIDS crisis, people were evicted from their apartments. They were denied health insurance. They were shunned by their families. And many people died in shame in the shadows. They were denied even burial. There were only in New York City two funeral homes that would embalm and bury people with AIDS.
And you knew people like this?
I did. I myself was forced onto long-term disability by a management consulting firm when I came down with full-blown AIDS. They would rather pay me not to work than to have me around working for fear that their clients would find out I had AIDS. And there were many people who I helped take care of because they were too ill to go shop, to cook meals, etc., and their family and close friends abandoned them.
It sounds unimaginably sad to somebody in this generation, especially now that we have a way to sort of keep people alive. I'm wondering how much this history is known and what this new memorial will commemorate.
One of the things we're trying to do with a memorial is to establish an online education center and an archive of the history of the epidemic. We're hoping this will empower others and teach them about community organizing and how social change can occur through activism.
What about the memorial itself, however, which is not online? It's very, very physical. It's about to open up today, World AIDS Day.
Well, a lot of its presence is intended to be, you know, a physical space, a monument that can't be ignored. It's, while it's not large in total area, it's a quite impressive structure that's almost three stories tall and is beautiful. And so it's hard to overlook. And the message is that speaking truth to power can work. And it is this space that attempts to connect and be a symbol of humanity so that people can remember those lives that were lost and to come together to remember those forgotten souls.
That was Eric Sawyer, a longtime AIDS activist and a board member of the New York City AIDS Memorial. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, Gambian voters are deciding today whether to keep longtime President Yahya Jammeh in power or choose a candidate backed by a united opposition. Jammeh has been in power for 22 years. His main challenger is Adama Barrow, a former businessman and leader of the United Democratic Party. Barrow has the support of eight opposition parties. A third presidential candidate, former ruling party official Mama Kende, is backed by the Gambia Democratic Congress Party. Jammeh, meanwhile, has predicted a landslide victory. He says he will not allow any political protests. Also, the Gambia's phone and internet services were turned off several hours before the polls opened. The African Union has sent some election observers, but the AP reports that neither the European Union nor ECOWAS has sent observers.
International students looking for a U.S. medical education face big challenges. Most public schools won't accept them, and private universities have very few openings for highly competitive slots. That said, it's not impossible. VOA's Linda Ring spoke to some international students at Johns Hopkins Medical School to see how they overcame the odds. Amy Katz narrates the report.
32-year-old Fatima Ismail knew she wanted to be a doctor as a young girl growing up in Dubai.
I was always fascinated with the brain and how it functions, and I love working with children. And there is a huge population of children with developmental disabilities that are not taken care of very well in Middle East in general and in my home country in particular.
So, after completing medical school in her home country, she applied for a training residency at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, where she had been an exchange student during medical school. Fatima is one of a select group of international students who is advancing her medical education in the U.S. Her peers have told her how they applied to dozens of programs.
It's a very competitive process. Being an international medical graduate, you have less chances to be accepted because, the priority would be for U.S. graduates. Having said that, it's not impossible. All what you need to do is basically what I think is early planning.
Planning is key for foreign students seeking admission to U.S. medical schools. Even if their home country studies are accepted, most programs require study in the U.S., prior to being considered for medical school, says Johns Hopkins Director for Medical School Admissions, Paul White.
So we say we want to see at least 1 year of additional coursework in any area in the U.S., just so we can see the kinds of courses they are capable of taking and how well they may perform in those courses. And there's no question that if they do well in the U.S. and they do well on the medical college admissions test, then they'll be eligible for admission.
India native Karum Arora is a fourth-year medical student specializing in ophthalmology. He was able to get into medical school because he also did his undergraduate studies at Johns Hopkins, as well as a two-year clinical research program in his field.
I can't even express in words how great my mentors were during those 2 years. And they were at Wilmer at Hopkins as well. And they both supported me when I applied for medical school, guided me through medical school, working on projects related to ophthalmology, and then are supporting me now as I apply for residency as well.
School administrators suggest that international students apply for residencies after completing medical school in their home countries or to come as an undergraduate. But even the most qualified applicant faces a highly competitive and very expensive road to becoming a doctor in the U.S. For Linda Ring, Amy Katz, VOA News.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.